So it's a nice feel-good movie. We would look at it and say, well, why didn't he want to make a more of a serious movie with John Wayne dying? And I would have done blah, blah, blah. But you know, 1966, you're piling the family into the station wagon and you go to watch El Dorado at the drive-in. And afterwards, it's like the community is reunited, is saved, and then you move on from that. And so it's really a nice Western at a time when Westerns and action movies were changing in Hollywood and becoming more cynical and less caring.
Well, we've been talking to Matthew of Gremlin Time.
This is a guilty pleasure.
A guilty
El
pleasure.
Dorado is a guilty pleasure that I'll watch every now and then.
You know, a movie doesn't have to be great to
No.
be enjoyed. It just has to be enjoyable to be enjoyed. And you know, everybody's hunting for masterpieces,
Right.
but there is pleasure to be had that's still educational. You know, the mistakes a movie makes are as educational as its successes. So anyway, we picked on this, or Matthew wanted to talk about it because it was an early James Caan movie and the actor passed away last week. And this is our opportunity to talk about where he came from and why he was so good.
So we're talking about El Dorado, 1966, Howard Hawks, John Wayne, Robert Mitchum, James Caan, Michelle Carey, and really good in this movie is Christopher George. Also in the movie is Ed Asner. And James Caan and Ed Asner would also appear together again in Elf.
Well, thanks again, Matthew, and thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. This has been Film and 11, and we will be back next week. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Much more to life than the things we can see, and the godliest mortal you ever will know is the one with the dream of El Dorado. So rise.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kbu.org to learn more. That's program@kbu.org.
From KRBX in Boise, Idaho, welcome to Radio Awakened, exploring the furthest reaches of human potential, the show that deep dives into the process of becoming the best of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Sapiro. Today's show is on living legends with scientist Dr. Bruce Lipton. My patients and students are often surprised to find undiscovered and unconscious beliefs that sabotage their growth and well-being. In this process of discovery and insight, coupled with increased self-awareness and self-love, we have the ability to not only elevate our own mental health and personal well-being, but our relationships to others, our communities, the planet, the cosmos, and all of that deepens and enriches. I often hear people groan when I mention positive thinking, because at first they think I'm being woo-woo, a Pollyanna, out of touch with the harsh and often difficult realities of their lives. But what I actually mean is that the way we respond to circumstances creates our reality. And while we all experience difficult circumstances and emotions, we can respond in a way that is restorative, growth-oriented, and brings back a sense of magic, awe and wonder into our lives, even while experiencing the very hardships that hurt us the most. We need to teach the unconscious mind to stop limiting our growth, to fully love us unconditionally, like the parents many of us wish we had, and to believe in our potentials and in our futures. We know from the research of biofield scientists, stress researchers, cellular biologists, and from decades of heart math research that our thoughts, beliefs, and emotions impact not only all of our own biological systems, but the electromagnetic field around all of us as well. What we think, believe, and emote has a direct influence on everyone's well-being and health. Talk about interdependence. Well, hopefully my guest, whose work revolutionized our understanding of the influence of beliefs on ourselves, he'll make this all very clear by the end of the show, and we'll all know what to do. Bruce Lipton, PhD, cell biologist and lecturer, is an international recognized leader in bridging science and spirit. Bruce was on the faculty of University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and later performed groundbreaking stem cell research at Stanford University. He is the best-selling author of The Biology of Belief, The Honeymoon Effect, and co-author with Steve Behrman of Spontaneous Evolution. Bruce received the 2009 prestigious Goi Peace Award from Japan in honor of his scientific contribution to world harmony. For more information, please visit brucelipton.com. Bruce, it's an honor to have you on the show. Thank you.
Mike, I am honored to be here, not just because of your abilities to help evolve this planet, you know, giving out knowledge. Knowledge is power. But I also appreciate it because we have a wonderful audience out there of people who are, I would call, cultural creatives, seeking answers that are not in the box in a time of chaos that we're experiencing. We're not doomed here. We have an opportunity to take our power back, which is your message for a long time, to create what we want. And I'm excited because that audience is ready and we have some information to share with them.
I think it's so cool how you went from a nerdy science like cell biology and ended up kind of preaching the heart gospel. I mean,
it surprises me at times too, you know. It's funny because as a cell biologist and working with cells, and I find myself in this like Watkins magazine in Great Britain lists 100 top spiritual teachers, and I'm in there like at 73 or something like that, and I thought, spiritual teacher, I'm a cell biologist, you know. So it always surprises me because this is the evolution. This is the evolution to know who we really are, and knowledge is power. And it's more important to look at it this way: a lack of knowledge is a lack of power. And then just add to this the concept of a misperception. A misperception about life means a lack of power, and we've been living under misperceptions that have disempowered us. And there's a renaissance, so to speak, in science, giving us great new insights to how powerful we really are. And that's what we need to know. This knowledge is power. Let's offer it.
So what is this message you'd like to share with my listeners and with me too? I mean, I've read your books, but I'd like to hear it really from you. Is how do we wake up to personal growth, thriving, and really evolution on a global scale?
Well, the first level, let's just come from a scientific fact, from the most valid science on this planet, and that is quantum physics. There is no science on Earth that has been tested more and affirmed to be truer than quantum physics. So if you're going to question a science, quantum physics is probably the last one. And I say, well, what's so relevant? I say, Max Planck, one of the founding fathers of quantum physics, recognize that the mind is the matrix of all matter. That's where the movie Matrix comes from. The mind is the matrix. And basically, what was the awareness of quantum physics? Consciousness is creating our life experience. And that's a fact of science. So in that fact of science, then I have to ask all the listeners out there, are you creating the life you want? Because if consciousness is creating our experiences, then why shouldn't we all be on, you know, heaven on earth and in love and in joy and all that? If we're creating experience, where's all the misery coming from? We've been programmed. The brain is a computer. It has all the functions that our silicon-based computers have, even though it's a carbon-based computer. It boots up in the last trimester of pregnancy, 3 months before you're born. It's already booted up. But like any computer, needs programs. And so how do you get programs to computer? And the answer is the brain functions at a different level of vibration. Vibration is the level of different characters of the nervous system. The vibration for the first 7 years is predominantly an energy field called theta. And theta is characterized behaviorally as imagination. And this is through age seven. So, you know, let's say a five-year-old is having a tea party, they pour nothing into the cup, they drink nothing and exclaim how wonderful the tea was. And I go, that's imagination. I go, yeah, but it's theta. And theta is hypnosis. And I say, so why is it relevant? You get the programs by observing your mother, your father, family, and community. By just observing them in theta, your brain is like a video recorder. It's recording behavior. That's a program. So how does a father behave? Well, watch your father. How does a mother behave? Watch her. Mm-hmm. How does the community behave? Watch them. Download. The first 7 years is downloading programs by simply observing them. There's a little problem with that, and that is the function of the brain at this time, theta, is not in the level of consciousness. It doesn't really predominantly get there until after age seven. So I say, so what does that mean? I say, well, while you're downloading programs, guess what? Your conscious mind isn't working. You go, so what? I go, no one's filtering the programs.
Right.
Whatever you downloaded, you downloaded some good programs, and I sure as heck know you downloaded some bad programs.
Yeah.
And nobody filtered them. But these are programs. And then after age seven, your consciousness is now able to integrate with the brain computer and use these programs, okay? The conscious mind, which is the one that physics is talking about, the consciousness creates the world we're in, okay? Well, there's self-consciousness and subconsciousness, and self-consciousness is the creative mind of humans. That's what makes us different than lower organisms. We have imagination. I say, so why is that important? Because then with a conscious mind, we can pursue an imagination and create. You have an idea. Let's go to the moon. Okay, first let's build a rocket. Oh, okay, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And then next thing you know, we build a rocket. And that's what makes us different. The problem is that there are actually two minds. When we say the mind, everybody goes, oh, mind. I go, no, two minds, interdependent. They both work independently, but they work together. And I say, it's conscious mind and subconscious. So what's the difference? Conscious mind is the one connected to your spirituality, the one connected to your source. So that's the creative mind. Conscious mind, creativity, imagination, wishes, desires, creativity. What about subconscious? No, go back. Subconscious, just program, just plain programs, okay? I say, so what? Well, when the conscious mind is operating, it has an opportunity to control the machine. To do what? Go toward imagination, wishes, desires, and what you want. And I go, so good. So the conscious mind can create. And I go, that's what quantum physics has been telling us. But then if you look at the world, I go, who is creating all this mess around here? And I go, well, we're creating all this mess. I said, well, that's not my intention. Intention is in the conscious mind. Subconscious mind, just program, flat out program, automatic, built into the hard drive. Push the button, play the program. Now, a lot of people think the subconscious is evil. You know, I go, no, subconscious got programmed, some good, some bad. A good program, walking. When did you learn how to walk? Before you were two. How old are you now? You could be 100 years old. You're still walking. I say, thank God. Why? Just imagine you had to wake up every day and learn how to walk every day. You spend the whole day just learning how to walk, and then you go to bed, and then you start all over the next day. I go, once you got the program, you got it for life. So the programs that we get in that first 7 years are there until we change them, are there for life. And I go, so why is it relevant? The conscious mind, creative, wishes, desires, the one with positive thinking. And you know, you mentioned that people think, oh, positive thinking is crazy, new age. Right. I go, hell no, it isn't. I'll tell you, scientifically, in allopathic medicine, it's been recognized for 75 years that the positive thinking is what is the drives the the healing that we call placebo. I go, what's that?
That's the placebo.
Sure. I've got a seriously deadly issue. A drug company gives us a new pill. The doctor says, this is a pill made just for you. And you take the pill and you get better. And you say, thank God for the pill. Then you find out the pill is a sugar pill. And then you're left with, well, the sugar pill didn't heal you, did it? I say, no.
Right.
What healed you? Belief in the sugar pill. That's where the healing came from. So all of a sudden it says, What do you mean belief has no issue? It's like one third to two thirds of all medical healings are placebo, which is what? Healing because you believe in the healing, not anything to do with the medical therapeutic aspect at all.
So this is a great place to reintroduce what we're talking about. We're on Radio Awakened. I'm talking to Dr. Bruce Lipton about the power of beliefs for changing our own health and our relationships to ourselves and others in the world. And right now we're really talking about the programming, the difference between our conscious mind, which has intention, creativity, imagination, and the subconscious mind that has the programming from probably before birth. As we know, our ancestors' experiences are written into our own DNA, to the way we think, just before we're even born. Why do so many of us walk around feeling victims of circumstance rather than feeling empowered to actually change and enhance our reality?
Well, the basic issue is this. Since the conscious mind is the creative one who wishes and desires imagination, mm-hmm. and the subconscious is just program, then I go, well, as long as the conscious mind is operating, it overrides the system and can manifest whatever we wish. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, then how can we have problems? And then comes the most serious scientific fact, and that is the conscious mind is only in charge of running our life about 5% of the day. Mm. And 95% of our behavior is strict playback from the programs that we got earlier. So the first question is, why only 5% of the day are we using that conscious mind to manifest heaven on earth? Well, the conscious mind has two functions. One, to look at the world and engage the world on the outside. But the conscious mind also can think. Subconscious is autopilot. Mm-hmm. Point. If the conscious mind is busy thinking, then whatever you're doing, driving a car, talking to somebody, doing a job that you know how to do, you automatically default to the program. Mm-hmm. So I say, so as long as you're thinking, then you're not running your life, because thinking means consciousness not even looking out the window. As long as you're thinking, then subconscious takes over and runs your life according to the program. Mm-hmm. Now, here comes the big monkey wrench, and that is this. As I said, the programs that you got were never filtered. So you got good programs and you got bad programs.
Right.
I go, well, if I got bad programs, how will I know? And I say, well, when you are playing these programs, first question is, why are you playing a program instead of creating? Because my creating mind is letting go and not mm-hmm. holding onto the steering wheel. So whatever my program is, it grabbed hold of the vehicle and is driving it, but according to the program. And I go, yeah, but these programs came from other people, and they're already infested with bad programs anyway. So I say, then the moment you are thinking, your life is no longer controlled by you. It is now controlled by the program. That's 95% of the day. And I go, well, yeah, let me just, I'll finish this one.
Sure.
Connect. And the point is, well, if I have a destructive program, then I'd be obviously, I would see I was being destructive. I go, that is the problem. Why? Why are you playing the program? Because conscious mind's not paying attention. So I say, well, why is that relevant? So whatever program is being played, you have no conscious awareness of the program. It's automatic because consciousness is thinking. So the same story, and I'll close with this for a moment, mm-hmm. is you have a friend, you know your friend's behavior very well, and you know your friend's parent. And one day you see your friend has the exact same behavior as their parent. And this is where you offer, like, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. And I say, back away from Bill. I know exactly what Bill's going to say the instant you say that. And Bill's going to say, how can you compare me to my dad? I'm nothing like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people laugh. And I go, because they've had this experience, I go, this is the most profound point of our story so far, Michael. And that is this. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad, except for Bill. I say, explain it. I say, sure. He got the behavior from his dad in the first 7 years of downloading behavior. But when he's playing the behavior, why is he playing it? Because his conscious mind's not paying attention. It's thinking. Mm-hmm. So whatever program is coming out, conscious mind is completely unaware of that program. I go, so why is this relevant? Well, 95% of your life is being played without you even being aware that you're participating in the program, because it's automatic. It's just coming from subconscious. Your conscious mind is busy. If you have a negative program, you will not see that you are even participating in a negative way. All you see is the result. And I go, this is where the problem comes from, because we wake up in the morning, conscious mind, today's the day I'm going to get healthy. Today is the day I'm going to find romance. Today I'm going to get a great job. Wishes, desires. And then they go out, and then they come home at the end of the day and go, it didn't work today. I go, why not? And they would say, well, I don't know. I'm the one that wanted wishes and desires, so it must be the outside. I'm a victim of that person, this thing, that thing. I'm a victim because I wanted this, I got this, and therefore I'm a victim. And I go, that is then all of a sudden the biggest problem in the world, because you're not recognizing they're not the ones giving you the problem. Your own subconscious program that you're not observing is undermining your wishes and desires if you download them from a source that's not living in harmony themselves. Mm-hmm. Most people say, I'm a victim. And I go, that's the problem. You're not a victim. You are creating this. If you own it, then you have an opportunity to change it. But if you perceive I'm just a victim, then you say, I have no power. This is just coming at me. I say, well, then you've lost the game. What you're saying is an expression of your programming. Rather than going out and saying the world is wrong and it's affecting me, the most important insight is to recognize my unconscious behavior has been sabotaging me. Mm-hmm. And that if I change that subconscious behavior, then I can have a different life. I go, yeah, that's the answer.
Mm. Well, there's the answer. Just become, it sounds like becoming aware of the 95% programming, how that's moving our train through our life and choosing the landscapes and the destinations for us.
Every aspect is programmed by existing programs, not our creative one.
Really looking at how our own beliefs, the 95% of that are unconscious are really the ones steering our ship. And when we end up in a destination we don't want to be at or didn't choose, we have to actually start becoming extremely aware of this underlying programming, these unconscious limiting beliefs that come from our families, our cultures, our teachers. Let's move toward the positive. We all want to thrive. We want to find out who we really are meant to be. Once we become aware of this programming, you know, and us in the psychological field, as a therapist, I have a lot of ways of helping people become aware and then shift toward their more heartfelt intentions, where the heart wants to go. But we have to be really aware of all that other programming. So is it possible to be 50-50? Is it possible, like some of my spiritual teachers who seem to live in the more conscious than unconscious realm? And I know that a lot of spiritual practices and psychological tools can lead us there. What do you suggest we do to get to that life of thriving?
Well, the first thing is, you know, let's recognize a wonderful example, and that is the movie The Matrix. Mm. The movie The Matrix starts out that we're all programmed. Well, I go, that's not science fiction, that's a fact. As we recognize, the first 7 years is programming, and that's it, we all got programmed. But then the significance is that in that movie, they say, well, you can take a blue pill or a red pill. And I say, well, you take the blue pill, you wake up, the program's just the way it's always been. It's just like waking up every day. But if you take the red pill, you get out of the program. And this is, to me, the most exciting thing, because what does it mean? You stop playing the damn program. I say, well, guess what? Science has recognized, and this is one group of people that's in our audience right now, Michael, that their life could have been blah, 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 blah. They meet somebody and they fall in love. Mm. I go, so what's the relevance? Because in 24 hours, their life is now completely different than it's been right up until that moment. I go, what do you mean? I go, no matter what they were talking about 24 hours ago, life, blah, 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 blah. And I say, 24 hours after being in love, they're living the honeymoon, which to me is heaven on earth. Mm. I go, all of a sudden, the blah, blah, blah life turned into this most beautiful life experience of living heaven on earth. I go, so what happened? It was just 24 hours. Science has recognized that falling in love like that is the equivalent of taking a red pill. And I go, what do you mean? I say, it keeps you in the present moment. It keeps you in the terms being mindful, which I'm sure you use a lot, the word mindful. I go, what does that mean? It says, I stop thinking. Being mindful, I'm present. I'm not thinking. I go, so what does it mean you're not thinking? I'm not playing the program. All of a sudden I go, instead of 5% of the day using my creative mind, when I fall in love, over 90% of the day I'm using the creative mind, which means what? Now I'm not manifesting my life from my program, I'm manifesting my life from creativity. And I go, yes. So blah, 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 program. And the day I took that red pill, I fell in love. The next day was, I'm now creating wishes and desires, and that's the honeymoon. And I say, so why is it relevant? because most people have experienced it. And I said, that's not an accident. It's a direct result of you stop thinking, because it's thinking that causes you to default to the subconscious. Staying present.
When you mean, I'm going to interrupt for a sec. When you mean thinking, please. I know through a long time meditation practice, the more I become aware of awareness itself that houses the thoughts, the less the thoughts arise, my nervous system relaxes, I have this output of thinking. But what are you, we have a few minutes left, so how do you get people to stop thinking? Is that
this is a very difficult one, because try to stay mindful in a world like we live in is one of the most difficult tasks of all, because there's so many things, you know, complicating our lives from outside that we have to think a lot. Okay, so I said, what can you do? And I say, well, first of all, recognize which programs are good ones and which ones are bad ones. I say, why? Because if I know there's a bad program, then I say, can I rewrite that program? And then the answer is yes. And I go, but the issue about rewriting a program is you're dealing not with a conscious creative mind. You're dealing with a subconscious mind, which is the habit mind. Mm-hmm. I go, why is it called a habit mind? Because that's where we learn habits like walking and talking, driving a car, playing an instrument. These are habits once you learn. I go, so why is it relevant? And the answer is that we have habits that are not supporting us. That's why we look at our world and go, mm-hmm. I'm not successful in relationship, health, job, whatever. I have a program that's obviously not supporting me. And I say, oh, well, now that you know what a program is, you can change a subconscious mind, but not by talking to it. That's what a lot of people are. I'm going to give myself a good talking to. And then I laugh because I said, well, who are you talking to? And I said,
it's the same mind. Yeah.
It's actually, you're talking to the conscious mind. Creative wants to talk to the subconscious mind. I go, problem. The subconscious mind's a hard drive. There's nobody in there. You have just as much success. Open up your computer, put on a program and say, no, I don't like this program, and talk to the computer and say, come on, change the program. I say, you can talk to your blue in the face. That's not going to change the computer. I go, talking to the subconscious is the same talking to a hard drive. Nobody's in there. It doesn't work, and it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. Because you see, I don't want this, and yet I keep telling myself not to do it, and I keep doing it. I go, because whoever you're talking to, there's nobody there. Subconscious is a hard drive. You got to change the program. I say, well, how do you change the program? Well, you have to open it up for record. Well, how do you record? Ah, that's what's different between conscious and subconscious. Conscious is creative. Anything you read, see, do, even just go, aha, I can change consciousness. Mm-hmm. Subconscious has got hardwired programs, their habits, selecting a program of what I want to be true in my life. One. Two, after age 7, I still learned things, but I did it by repetition and practice. Mm-hmm. And so the new agey thing I always laugh at is called fake it till you make it. Hmm. What does that mean? I said, well, you're living a crummy life and you don't like it. I say, well, then start faking it as if you really like it.
Right.
Just fake it every day, as many times during the day. It's like, oh, I love my life. I love my life, or whatever. You know, I'm happy. I'm happy. And I say, just keep saying that, because repetition will then create a program. Mm. And after you repeat it enough times, let's say I'm happy, you don't have to wake up and say I'm happy anymore, because now it's a program. You wake up, you're automatically happy. And for 95% of the day, you will be playing everything automatically from happy. Mm. So the two ways, the fundamental ways of learning are self-hypnosis, earphones at night, going to bed, repeat this process. Mm. Second way of learning is create a new behavior, repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, and become habit. And there's a point where after it gets to a certain point, you don't have any more work to do. In either of these cases, installing them is not very hard. And then once the behaviors are installed, there's no more effort. Why? Because they'll run 95% of the day without you even being involved. So this is the cool part. And then lastly, and most importantly, is we have a necessity to change behavior as a civilization as fast as we can, because civilization has precipitated a mass extinction of which we're a part of. We're going extinct as an organism on the planet, and not in 1,000 years, within decades. And I go, what's it due to? Because human behavior is undermining the web of life. So I say, well, then what can we do? I say, you got to change behavior. You got to change it fast. The first two, hypnosis and repetition, are longer processes, but there's a new one called energy psychology, which engages something called super learning. Super learning, example, somebody reading a book and moving their finger down the page, just like that, can read all the words as fast as they just did that. Super learning. Well, if you can engage super learning as a belief change process, then you can change a belief you had your whole life, 40, 50, 60 years. You can change that belief in 10, 15 minutes using energy psychology. About 25 versions of modalities of energy psychology with their websites. And so I just suggest that people go to my web, brucelipton.com, look under belief change, and read a little thing about each one. Find one. Why? Because I know for a fact, because even my own life was radically changed in minutes using one of the processes. And it's like, oh my God, I understand it. I've lived it. And it's like, we don't have to suffer. We don't have to work hard. It's just learning how to push the record button. And if you can push that record button, you can change those programs. I say, and what's the result? Once the program is changed, there's no more work. Now it's automatic program. It'll work 95% of the day without you doing any effort. That's the beautiful part. It's not like a hard lifelong struggle. I go, no, once the program is in, struggle's over.
Well, that's where we got to end it there on the struggle's over.
The struggle is over.
The struggle is over by just becoming aware of and reprogramming those old habits and conditions of mind that were really installed even before we were seven and even before birth, actually. I really appreciate you being on and sharing all of this knowledge and wisdom, and I hope people do check out your website and then follow some of those pathways toward the energy psychology practices in hopes of waking up. Thank you so much for being on our show today, Bruce.
Michael, I am so honored to be with you. I so appreciate what you're doing, because evolution is a required movement at this moment, or death is going to come. And your program is offering the wisdom and knowledge to help us move to that next level.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. Thank you. There you have it, folks. Waking up and creating heaven on earth is possible for all of us. And a reminder, this is your life to live. So dare to dream and live big and become who you're meant to be. This is Radio Awakened. I'm Dr. Mike Spiro.
KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. When Oregon's medical marijuana program was initially set up, business, in fact, commerce of any kind, was prohibited. Growers could not be reimbursed for expenses. They certainly couldn't be paid for their labor. Two initiatives that would have allowed grower reimbursements and even dispensaries, one in 2004, the second in 2010, were defeated at the polls. Following that 2010 measures defeat, dispensaries started springing up all across the state. I should know, I ran one in Portland. The state legislature in 2013 passed a law to regulate medical marijuana businesses in the state. This is following the defeat the year before of the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, which would have legalized adult use sales. A different adult use legalization measure was voted on and approved in 2014. So the legal medical marijuana business in Oregon is only a little bit older than the legal adult social use marijuana business in the state. And they do still coexist. There is still an Oregon medical marijuana program. There's still a need for one. There were people out there, opponents, who claimed that medical marijuana was merely a stalking horse for legalization. And there have been some legalizers, admittedly, who also scoffed at medical. And all of them were wrong. Now, one of my good friends, Michael Kravitz, has been working tirelessly on medical marijuana for a long time now. I had the pleasure of speaking with him recently. According to his Wikipedia page, quote, Michael Kravitz is a U.S. Air Force veteran, executive director of the nonprofit Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access, and international advocate for cannabis policy reform with FAT Think and Do Tank, end quote. Now, although that information came from Wikipedia, I know those things are true because Mike Kravitz is also one of my good friends, and I have the great good fortune to have him on the line with me now. Hey, Mike.
Oh, that's so sweet. It's great to be here, Tank.
It's good to have you here, man. It's good to have you. Happy 2021 before we get started. Happy 2021.
Thank you.
So now, there is so much happening in the world of medical cannabis, it's kind of hard to decide where to start. But, you know, let's go with the international scene first, because there was a big change there. And moving forward, I think that's something that we really do need to understand. And you've been working with the Vienna and the New York NGO committees. You've been there at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs and the World Health Organization meetings. You've been working this thing for years. So there is literally no one better to discuss this with than you. So what is going on internationally?
Well, you know, when I got out of high school, unlike my oldest sister, I had no intention of changing the world. That wasn't one of my, you know, bucket list things, to-do list. But nonetheless, that's what our team did. Quite a team is somewhat drawn from the elite of our cannabis movement worldwide. We've been working inside the United Nations under the, you know, sort of ad hoc moniker of the pro-cannabis team. And right at my side are Kenzie Rigoulet of Mouly and Farid Gayoche from France and Barcelona, respectively. And what we did and what we accomplished was nothing short of changing the international law as it pertains to cannabis as a medicine. And we have rolled back and eliminated and replaced the longstanding World Health Organization recommendations against using cannabis as a medicine, and have replaced them with robust instructions on how to use cannabis as a medicine. This is something that Russia didn't like, Nigeria didn't like, a lot of countries in their camp objected strongly to. One, you know, with the most extreme, craziest stuff that you could ever imagine, saying that if you would lower any of the, you know, kind of control on cannabis, then they're going to have trouble supporting their use of the death penalty. Of course, you got to keep death penalty on the table for cannabis. That was Indonesia, by the way. But this is the final, you know, culmination of 10 years of hard work. In the 2nd of December, the United Nations voted to accept the recommendations of the World Health Organization to change the classification of cannabis and remove it from the most dangerous drug list.
So now, what does this international rescheduling mean in terms of U.S. policy?
It's kind of like, you know, if you look at the U.S. drug policy as sort of a house made of bricks on top of a house made of cards, you know, we've been working on punching those bricks for 50 years, and I just somehow found my way to the basement and pulled out a key card out from the foundation. Seriously, the United States of America, after Timothy Leary won his case in 69 and the U.S. federal law was thrown out as unconstitutional, they replaced it, as you know, history book stuff, with the Controlled Substances Act. And the Controlled Substances Act, purpose, implemented our obligations of this treaty that we signed in 1961 on the International Treaty on Drugs, so-called Single Convention on Narcotics. And ever since then, we've been hitched at the hip to this treaty. And it's funny because you would never really know this as a cannabis activist until you got way up there. You know, when you're in court fighting against the DEA, that's when all of a sudden the DEA tells the judge, well, no, we can't do that because of the treaty you're on. And it's just absolutely every single time that's the final brick wall that we get stuck at right before they, you know, they use their extreme power to just overrule the entire system, which is the other scenario in which we've lost. So, yeah, it's a phenomenal thing that right at the moment where we're changing command, we have a president that has expressed interest in, you know, changing the schedule of cannabis. We just broke the glass ceiling of where cannabis can be scheduled. Up till now, our attorney general, given this authority by the Controlled Substances Act of the United States, has deemed, based on our treaty obligations, that cannabis had to be in either Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. It's a matter of record. And now, as a matter of record, the treaty under which that decision was underpinned has been changed, and the Attorney General will have to make a new determination. This will be a new Attorney General that is probably one of the most fair people to ever make this, if we actually get the judge that is now, you know, in the nomination process to be Attorney General to be Attorney General.
Well, I will say I looked at part of his record, and of course he was there was a medical cannabis ruling that he ended up, or medical cannabis suit that he ended up rejecting, but it was on a very narrow interpretation of regulatory law, not about the merits of the case. It was simply that DEA's thing, and they said no, and that's the end of that, which was a cop out in a way, but it didn't really speak to how, you know, he didn't touch the question of whether medical cannabis, whether it should happen. He just went narrowly on the nothing I can do. That's just the way the law reads.
This is going to be really a case of interpreting the change in the treaty. I'll tell you this, our team has already sort of foretold in our estimation that the DEA will make a strong case that cannabis should not be in Schedule 2 based on the treaty change. But we would then counter with what? Of course, that was already an option on the table, that we already had this ceiling of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 before. The treaty was just changed in a substantive way. You mean to tell me that makes no change in U.S. policy? See what I mean? We got a pretty strong argument against the DEA's position that we expect. So I think that this will open it up to a discussion, a rational discussion. I think the end of that rational discussion is probably going to come to Schedule 3, which puts cannabis on par with the active ingredient in cannabis, perhaps Schedule 4. I don't really see, you know, it's just a matter of negotiations, us getting Schedule 5, and I don't think there's a really good argument for it to be taken out of schedule based on the new classification in the treaty. So that's kind of the hard truth of the situation, but, you know, that's what I deal with.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Kravitz, a longtime drug policy reformer and director of the group Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. We'll have more in a moment. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Oregon Health Forum recently held a panel discussion on the upcoming Oregon legislative session. One of the items they discussed was the implementation of Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which was approved overwhelmingly in the 2020 general election. Here are Oregon State Representative Rob Noce and State Senator Deb Patterson, both Democrats. The question is posed by Becky Holtberg, President and CEO of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
Now that these ballot measures have passed, how is Oregon going to finance the necessary services to treat those who have been deferred? But essentially, how are we going to fund treatment now that we've passed these ballot measures that decriminalize some of these substances?
I'll start. So that's actually the big ballot measure 110 question. The measure actually says we're going to fund treatment by taking cannabis tax dollars that we're currently spending on schools and county services and fund it in the treatment space designed by ballot measure 110. And I think it's going to be incumbent upon all of us legislators to examine that strategy and figure out if we can afford it, or if the governor, maybe not a year delay in the implementation of that ballot measure, but if the governor has a little bit of a point about, like, we've got to figure out what we're currently funding with marijuana tax dollars, and do we need to continue that? So that's going to be the big, I think, question around ballot measure 110 is how do we implement it and pay for it at the same time? So a lot to come on that.
Yes, Senator Patterson.
I would like to add that there are some things too that are complementary to that I think will help to address some of those issues. For example, the navigation centers for helping folks who are currently homeless, a number of whom have substance abuse issues. That funding was left on the table earlier this year, and I think that as we revisit that, it's coming back. That will also provide some funding that had already been built in. So,
all right. Any
Cannabis, a lot of maybe the growth on cannabis and marijuana taxes will help us cover the cost of that. For listeners that read the Business Journal, that continues to be a growth industry. Oregonians are buying those products and paying those taxes, pretty significantly. So maybe we'll be able to sort of grow ourselves out of this problem. But for the moment, I think trying to figure that out is going to be one of our challenges.
That was Oregon State Senator Deb Patterson and State Representative Rob Noce. They appeared recently on a webinar sponsored by the Oregon Health Forum to discuss the upcoming legislative session. Welcome back. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you're listening to Free Culture Radio. Let's hear more from that interview with Michael Kravitz, Director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access.
I don't know if you want to put politics into this, but it's hard not to. As we're recording this, it's a week after the Capitol was attacked, the police were killed, and violent neo-Nazis carrying rebel flags running around shouting Trump slogans inside our Capitol. It's hard not to say something about it. Today, the president was impeached a second time. The Congress House voted to impeach him, and now it's off to the Senate for a trial, if they should try to do so this time for real, because this is really scary. And the one thing that nobody said today that I just thought I would say is that, and it's just amazing, nobody said it, nobody thought it, I don't even know if anybody thought it, maybe they're not looking at it as real a threat as I am, but, they talked about the threat that President Trump poses very clearly. However, what about responsibility for a future act? Should the president do something horrible between now and a week from now, the House has done their diligence. They've done their job. If the Senate doesn't come in tomorrow and finish the process and take him out of office, and the next day he does something horrible, it disgraces our country even further, causes even more loss of life because of his fill in the blank, I think that the House is going to be able to stand tall and proud and say, they did their job. It was the Senate of the United States that holds the responsibility. And I would imagine that would be about the biggest cleaning of house that you've ever seen in U.S. history. God forbid such a thing happens, but this guy, President Trump, is the most scary person in government I've ever seen in the United States in my life. And what happened last week was a disgrace, and he was most obviously the ringleader.
It's, yeah. I have seriously said for months that I thought it was going to all come down to noon on January 20th. The Marine Guards do their duty and escort, frog march him out the back door, because I doubt he really plans on leaving willingly, but then duty's their duty.
And, they have 150,000 photos to dig through of evidence. The U.S. Capitol has been cordoned off as a crime scene. Well, what many didn't realize was that using Facebook and stuff like that, live streaming their crimes, breaking into and destroying capital property, which some of it is heirloom treasures of the United States, stuff made by our founding fathers by hand, that's now been tear gassed and has to be carefully cleaned. When they use their cell phone, the cell phone tower is downstairs inside the Capitol. Every single, you're afraid of the big brother, big companies watching this big company happen to be big brother. They actually just put their name right on the list when they turn on their cell phone inside the Capitol like that. It is 160 something like that open cases. It's clear that the law enforcement is taking this seriously. The army net now that has been brought together from the National Guards is now bigger around the Capitol than we have in Iraq. I was just saying that that was basically in the sentence. I mean, think about that. Think about the fact that we now have a standing army protecting this inauguration. But that's kind of mind-boggling. And you know, I'll say one more thing, if I could, one more second.
Oh, please.
The Republicans kept making, there was a lot of different arguments, and there was actually a couple of you know, kind of heartfelt pleas that you know, sounded pretty interesting and had some convincing details. But the overarching argument from the Republicans was that there's no time to impeach him. This would just be sort of to divide this country. Why would you even do this? Which, oh my God, you know, do they not remember the last two times we had something like that, where there was a Supreme Court judge that the President Obama couldn't put through because it was too close to his end of term, but yet President Trump put through a Supreme Court judge in half that amount of time, just not that long ago. So this would be the third time in a short period of time that same issue came up of, oh, there's not enough time. And that completely, you know, evades the central issue, which is, it doesn't matter about these last days. It matters that we've done everything we can to protect the country from the president, and it matters that he never, ever can run for office again, which would be the outcome of this successful impeachment.
Well, absolutely. It's, I mean, it was horrifying. The images were horrifying, and it's an outrage that. What divided the country? What divided the country was what happened on January 6th. And what's sad is that it in any way divided the country. I mean, oof.
I hear a lot of, you know, different conspiracy theories out there. Obviously, it's a crazy time for conspiracy theories. But, you know, this really isn't rocket science. I mean, if you go into a theater, I mean, this has been always the thing, right? Just like, you know, the basic medical necessity argument for marijuana, it was based on basic necessity argument, which is, remember what? You know, you steal a boat to save a drowning child. They're not going to arrest you for stealing the boat. That's a necessity argument. And, you know, everybody really probably already knows the basic, you know, freedom of speech line in the sand. What is it? Crowded movie theater. You can't stand up and start yelling fire when there's no imminent threat to the place actually burning down. If you're lying about that and people get hurt, then you're responsible for that damage. You're responsible for that injury. You're responsible for that crime of inciting that outcome. And President Trump has knowingly lied to the American people. I've done it as 20,000 times, I think, so far during his presidency. He said broke every record imaginable. But this lie in particular, the lie that he could still win this election even after he lost, was the most damaging. And it's the one that fueled the neo-Nazi hate groups like the Proud Boys to stand up and stand tall, or whatever their slogan was, that Trump rather obviously repeated by heart after quite a bit of preparation. It seemed like that was the thing that he prepared for in that. And I'm not being picking on him, honestly. That was obvious. Watch that whole debate. And that was the moment. He baited them into it carefully by saying, name them. Who is it? Who is you talking about? And they said, well, what about the Proud Boys? Because, of course, it's the only, like, real name we know. And he was ready to say their slogan on national TV to tell them to stand up and stand ready. For what? To come storm the Capitol. He's a monster. He's a monster.
By the time this airs, he's a monster who's no longer occupying the White House, and we'll see. I know that was the idea. Wait until the Senate was officially in the hands of the Democrats before running the actual trial. I don't know if that's, well, I guess we'll find out in the next few days. The problem of doing an advance record, we don't get to find out what happens.
I can pretty much guess that the future is going to be, you know, this isn't going to be taken up by the Senate until the day before the inauguration, where they'll drag the process and hand it off to the next administration, or try to kill the process in one day. Either way, knock on wood that the president doesn't, you know, do something horrible between now and then, and we can just go on and not have the hugest stain on the Senate as already is, and it's bigger stain.
We can but hope and pray and work for it. Hey, so Mike, thank you for all the time, man. This is it's always good to hear from you. It's good to talk to you, and I'm glad that you're I'm glad you're doing this stuff. Where do people keep up with you on the web and on social media?
Facebook is our place to hang out. It's funny, even on Facebook, you know, this discussion came up because of the president getting kicked off Facebook, and you know, people. The First Amendment and the protection of free speech is not to protect the president from the people. It's to protect the people from the president. Read it. Anyway, Facebook, we're still on there, even though we talk about marijuana and that's illegal. They've given us at least that much room, and we're still there. and find us there. But Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access, you can find us out on the web. And Veterans Action Council, like I said, Facebook presence and on YouTube. Definitely look us up.
Well, absolutely excellent. You're still on social media, and I am too. You know, in different organizations, where you know the drug policy reform organizations are, but we do have to be a little careful of what we say and what we do and what we have on there. I've run Google advertising accounts for nonprofits, and because of a drug mention in a Twitter feed, the account got briefly suspended. And then let's not even talk about the various people who have legal dispensaries who've had their Instagram accounts frozen or shut down, and their Facebook limitations on the things that they can talk about because of this whole federal nonsense.
Doug, we have a much more systemic relationship with that as a cannabis movement. One of the instances that I would point to, of many that I could point to, would be National Normal. Of course, Normal, the National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws, used to be repeal of marijuana laws, remember their old slogan, but they changed it to reform of marijuana laws, and they became more conservative. But they raised an enormous amount. It was actually a Virginia activist that left Virginia Normal and went to join National Normal, and first thing she did was to get millions of people onto her Facebook page. And when the president, that president was President Obama, set up a White House petition thing, the very first petition was on marijuana, and they got enough signatures to pass the petition threshold in 1 hour. And it made all kinds of news, and it was, it's rigged from the opposition and everything, and Facebook was embarrassed that this marijuana thing had enough, clout to be able to do something like that, and they stripped them of it. And not once, but I think twice, they've been knocked down to zero. So, yeah, we get, our rhetorical boxing gloves on, going back and forth with the system as a movement. We get knocked down, we stand back up, we don't cry about it.
Do you remember during the Brian Eppes trial, the billboards that we were trying to arrange out in California for the trial, that my daddy's not a criminal, billboards they refused because it talked about the marijuana issue. Yes, because they were trying someone, the unfairness of these things. And, on the other hand, when that happened, it made a great news story. So, almost as good as having one of the darned billboards without having to be the schmuck who's paying for a billboard,
Yeah, right. So I'm burning to close this out with a thought, right? We came from this movement to where Normal was having their first meeting in the 1970s with no kidding, Officer Stadenko on the other side of the wall with a little microphone stuck to the wall at the conference center to try to hear what they were saying in their meetings to get intel on the marijuana movement. And we've gone from that to having, in just 1 week, our main champion in the Senate, Kamala Harris, Senator becoming Kamala Harris, Vice President, in making all kinds of history and being the champion of the MORE Act that we were talking about before, the marijuana legalization package that is as bold as anything that's ever come down the pike. This is a very different world, and I'm really happy to be here. And if it wasn't for recent events, even with COVID, I'm pretty optimistic. But these are tough times. I wish everybody well and much love, and hunker down, wear a mask, and see you on the other side.
Oh, Michael, it's so good to hear you, brother. I love you, man. You take good care of yourself, man. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much.
Have a good one, man.
Cheers.
That was my interview with Michael Kravitz. He's a good friend, a longtime drug policy reformer, and director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. He's doing an event at the end of January for the nonprofit group Compassionate Oregon. You'll have to go to the Compassionate Oregon website for details about tickets. Because for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thank you to everyone out there who's fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. Many thanks to my guest, Michael Kravitz. A big thank you to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. The music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. Find Free Culture Radio on the web at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio is on Facebook at facebook.com/kboofreeculturradio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!